And I get the honor of introducing our speaker. And I have known our speaker, 18 and a half years? Is that right? It was in this room. I was sitting in this room in the Saturday women's meeting at 11 o'clock, when it used to be at 11 o'clock. And this young lady walked in, and you could tell she was beaten and broken. And as the weeks progressed, she was here every Saturday at that 11 o'clock meeting. And the thing is, she didn't have a driver's license. She had to be brought to meetings. She had to be brought to work. And to see where she started to where she is now, it's truly an amazing story. And I have heard a lot of it, but never in its entirety, sort of entirety, because we do only have like 45 minutes. But I'm excited to hear her story today, and I give you Jamie P.
I can remember when there was 100 people in here for First Friday. Thank God it's not that way tonight. So I'm Jamie. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just going to jump right in. I will go back and forth between the then and now, so I don't spend too much time in the drunkalog. So I grew up in Atlanta, in the city limits of Atlanta, south of Buckhead. And I grew up in a very, very stable family. There was no abuse. We went to church every Sunday. No fighting, just very functional and stable. However, like I said, I grew up south of Buckhead, and the two schools that I went to were in the heart of Buckhead. And my friends didn't just live in big houses, they lived in the mansions out there on West Paces. And these were my peers. The church I went to was downtown Atlanta. It was a lot of old Atlanta money from out near Emory University, also the big houses, big mansions and stuff. So those were my peers from a very early age. And definitely felt not a part of or less than, you know, from an early age. I had my first drink at 13 years old. I was over spending the night over with some of the neighbors across the street, 14-year-old brother, 10-year-old daughter that I played with, and then 13-year-old me. Their parents did drink, and there was never any drinking. I'd never been around alcohol at all. Pulls out the vodka and orange juice in for decades. A whole lot. I think I drank close to a blackout, but I don't remember feeling bad. I was pretty scrawny back then, so I don't remember throwing up, feeling sick at my stomach or anything the next day. What I do remember is these two saucer-sized bruises on the inside of my knees. Don't remember how I got them. What I do remember is, when can I do this again? To these rooms many years later, my first speaker meetings, I can remember those exact words coming out of people's mouths about their first drink. When can I do it again? And like I said, surely I threw up or was sick or something, but that's not what I remember. So I never really thought my life, I never really thought that I drank again until I was 16 and started dating. And fast forward again to being in rehab here, and we had the assignment of doing our drinking history, starting with our first drink and going. I had that first drink at 13, and then I really didn't drink. Between 13 and 16, I babysat a lot. three families I babysat for were drinkers. Now, I don't think they ever came home and found me in a blackout or, you know, kid laying over there. You know, I was responsible. When I step any further. Okay. So then in 1972, when I turned 18 years old, a most wonderful thing happened for a little budding alcoholic like me. Georgia lowered the drinking age from 21 to 18. Awesome. Didn't have to get anybody to buy it for us. We could not only could go buy it, we could go hang out in the bars. And so that was really cool. Went to college in South Georgia and loved it. I hated growing up in the city. I was not a city girl. I'm still not a city girl. Give me dirt roads and, you know, countryside. And that's what I love. So being down there in Valdosta, Georgia, racing through the backwoods and all Pink Floyd cranked up and smoking weed. And, you know, drinking, those were my salad days, I thought. I pursued a nursing career, and I went into nursing because, not because I had the Florence Nightingale dream in my heart. No, I wanted to make sure I got a job when I graduated. My older brother had graduated with a degree in biology, and you couldn't do a damn thing with it. Unless he went on to get a master's or something to teach or whatever. And I said, I'm not doing that. I want to be able to always get a job. That'll become pertinent in a little bit. So I got my bachelor's degree in nursing at Valdosta State, met my future ex-husband there, and he was seeking his, he was getting his bachelor's in business. These degrees will become pertinent in just a minute. A year later, we got married and moved to Athens, where he continued to seek an MBA there. And we had a great time there. I mean, we got hooked up with people. We were both very much adrenaline junkies, and we canoed and kayaked and whitewater canoed and backpacked and ran the Peachtree Road Race. We just, throughout our marriage, we did a lot of very, very, very cool things. However, he just never lived up to his potential. And I had a problem with that, a big problem with that. He was frequently 7 and 8 months between jobs. And I'm over here in intensive care unit working my ass off, night shift, holidays, weekends, doubles, and he's, you know, kind of just sitting back. And so resentment started building up. I say that, but also, like I said, to go back to the fun times, he was a great entertainment chairman. You know, planned all these trips that we did. We saw some, you know, we did some great stuff. Saw the Northern Lights up in Canada. Just did some really awesome, awesome adventures. And that kept things buried for a while, the resentments that were building up over a 20-year marriage. And I want to stop real quick and just read something that pertains to that. You know, I never wanted, you know, I didn't come from wealth, and I was not seeking out to be wealthy or anything like that, but I just had a problem with a man that wouldn't live up to his potential. I just had a problem with that while I'm over here doing what I'm doing and making the contributions to the family unit that I'm doing. And just 1 minute. So in our big book, it says resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. So I was well on the road to that during that marriage. So we got, like I said, I just couldn't respect the man anymore, and I said, I cannot grow old with someone that I don't respect. Now, we stayed cordial. We had a very amicable divorce. I think we left the attorney's office and went to the Cobb County Library book sale and to lunch. Now, I don't, who does that? Who gets a divorce and then goes and does that? The way it is with us today, like I said, I'm jumping into the future, back to how it is now. He's remarried. We are great friends. I am great friends with her. She and I have done things without him. He and I will talk on the phone without her. We all know our roles and our places, and nobody's out. There is no jealousy. There's nothing underhanded in trying to make it something it's not. He and I cherish some great memories. We talk about them. She shows much grace. We're at my house dying laughing over this stuff. And it's just real cool. You know, life's just too short to hate. I did leave out something before the divorce, back into our marriage. I left out a couple important things. We have a son, and there was some domestic violence in the marriage. Now, don't go feeling sorry for me that you think I'm a battered wife. I got some good hits in, you know. And I was always the one to take the first hit. In my drunkenness, and then what I just read about the resentments and the spiritual malady, you know, he would say something, we'd be drunk and be having a good time up until he would say something just a little abrasive, and I'd haul off and slap the shit out of him. I think I threw a T-bone steak at him one time. So anyway, and our son saw and heard way more than a little boy should. Fast forward again, our son's in the Navy. Michael and I are going down to the airport. He's coming home on leave, and we're going down to the airport to pick him up. And he's sitting next to another sailor on the plane. He says, so who's picking you up, man? And he goes, my parents. And he goes, your parents? I thought you said they were divorced. And he said, oh, they are. And the other guy said, well, how does that work? He said, real well. That was his answer, real well. Because it does. And that's how we are today. That's our friendship today. Like I said, life's too short to hate and to be totally engulfed in this resentment thing. He was one of my hardest amends to make. It took me about 3 years into sobriety before I could make that amend, because see, even at that point, I was keeping score. He had a good bit more to do with the demise of the marriage than I did, but this program taught me that I'm not keeping score. I keep my side of the street clean. I don't have to own his stuff. I don't have to worry about that. And you know, I thought I would get some kind of snide remark when, of course, I'm crying my eyes out. So I've just got to talk to you. I've got to say this. And when I said, I'm just really sorry for all my drinking and a lot of the stuff I caused, and he could not have said anything more perfect to me. He said, well, I wasn't the best husband either. And I had waited years to hear that. So that was very cool. All right, let me think just a minute where I want to go to next. Well, I will get into what happened. So we were divorced, and like I said, we were very cordial, even partied together for a year or two. And he got into another relationship, and then I think a year later, I got into another relationship. And but that first year after we were divorced, he was bartending somewhere up in Woodstock, I think, where one of those, they used to have those race cars things and all. And you know, so what's up with that? You have a bar in there with people running around a track at, what, 80 miles an hour? You know, whatever. I mean, I wasn't up there to race anyway, but because he was the bartender, you know, I could get the top shelf drinks at a Kmart price, Walmart price. And so went up there, hung out, and I remember him walking me to the car and going, are you okay? What do you think my answer was? Yeah, Yeah, I'm fine. On the way home, I got my first DUI about 4 miles from my house in the city of Smyrna. And they've got the best jail. Their jail is so much better than Cobb County. But so went to that jail, had some consequences of it, and you know, was working through them. My parents never knew anything about that. I can remember when I was doing community service, and you have to wear those jackets and all like that, and so I had to go pick up trash out on South Cobb Drive. And I live about 10 minutes from my parents. They just live down the way. And I was just so scared that they were going to drive down South Cobb Drive and see me over there picking up trash on the side of the road. I mean, I could just see him in the car. Sam, slow down. Is that Jamie over there? You know, picking up trash and all. But they, luckily, they didn't know anything about that and got through those consequences okay. So then about, I don't know, a couple of years later, I was asked to resign from my job. They didn't terminate me, thank goodness, so that was not on my record, but they asked me to resign. It was because of so many tardies. And some co-workers, I think, had smelled alcohol on my breath. One of my friends, co-workers, was courageous enough to confront me and say, we need to go get you some coffee, and this is not the first time somebody has smelled this on you. Well, it gave me a little bit of a scare, but, you know, not enough. And so they asked me to resign, and the irony of that, remember, I went into nursing so I could get a job, and then by my very own making, I lost that job. So I went to work down at Emory Midtown in downtown. I did not even get through orientation, and I got pulled into another room with management because they smelled alcohol on my breath. I haven't even made it through orientation yet. For some reason, they didn't fire me. I have no idea why they kept me. In the meantime, I had gotten into a relationship. I'd been in a relationship about 2 years. And so on February 14th of 2005, that's Valentine's Day, y'all, a day of love, I got a DUI. There was no love in that day. So this is number two in less than 5 years. I started getting through the consequences of that, and I think maybe my license was suspended at that time. I don't know. It may have just been a 30-day thing. I don't really remember. But started having some consequences of that. Then in April of 2005, I went to court for that DUI on Valentine's Day with Judge Roland Castellano. And so I get out of court that day, and he had, whatever, my license was suspended then for sure, and read off the community service that I had to do, and the probation, and blah, 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 blah. And the ex-husband had gone out of was going out of town that day. So now, when we got divorced, I got primary custody of the child, and he got primary custody of Wilbur the dog, the Dalmatian. So I got into court that day, and he was going out of town, so he brought Wilbur the Dalmatian over, a little bit of coke, had a little bit of weed, started drinking. Did I mention I just got out of court that day? So this is in the afternoon that I did that. I think there was some Ambien or Xanax or something in there too. And I was almost out of weed. Well, I can't have that. So I called the boyfriend up. Do you have some weed? And he said, well, we're having a little spat at the time. So he said, yeah, but you got to come over here and get it. Yeah, he only lived 3 miles from me. If you want to know the insanity of this disease, it made perfect sense to me with Ambien on board, weed on board, cocaine on board, alcohol on board. I had just opened a gooseneck bud in the bottle. Well, that's going to be flat by the time I get back. So let me take that open container and put it in my console. I'm only going a couple of miles. Wilbur, come on, you get in too. I don't remember leaving the road. I was already in a blackout, smashed into a tree. When I saw my car later, it's amazing that my head didn't get sliced off. I woke up in Kennistone Hospital with my two little parents looking over me. And my mother told me later, when she got the phone call from the cops, that they were calling about me and I was at the hospital. She said, "Is she alive?" Because they honestly thought I was dead. And they were going to, had to go identify, maybe go identify a body. I can remember several times before that, they would call and I would answer the phone. I wouldn't look at caller ID and, you know, slur, "Hey," and she would just go, "Honey, when are you going to get some help?" So they were, I put them through a lot. And it's not like I was, you know, in my 20s, guys. I mean, you know, I'm well into middle age. And for them to have to worry about that. So I'm laying there in Kennistone Hospital, and of course the nurse has to come in and read the tox screen in front of them. You know, if it had just been alcohol, you know, they would have known that. But oh no, when they saw the opiate and the cocaine and all like that, they're going, "Who is this? Who is this? This is not who we raised, how we raised her." And that was always a real issue with me in getting sober, was because I didn't understand, because of the way I grew up, I didn't know about the disease of alcoholism until I got here. I did not understand what was wrong with me. For me, it was a moral issue. And I did not understand how this little Southern Baptist girl had grown up in the church, and she knew better. It's not like she grew up in a dysfunctional family where there was screaming and hate and hitting and drinking and mama screwing Bubba back there in the bedroom and stuff, you know? I didn't grow up like that, and I knew better, so I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought it was a moral thing. So anyway, I got out of the hospital, had to, I think I had to go turn myself in or something, but got bailed immediately back out, and went and got Wilbur out of jail. You know, they took him to the shelter, so I had to go get Wilbur out. And the guy that I was seeing at the time, he said something very profound to me, something I would have probably never considered. I mean, it's a duh, but something I would have never considered. He said, "You need to go to rehab, or you're going to do some time." And I knew the gig was up then, at least for a little while, maybe not forever, but the gig was up. Because I said, if I have to do, and the prosecution ultimately did want me to do it a minimum 6 months. If that had happened, I would have lost my career for sure. I'd almost lost it, I'd gotten reemployed. I wouldn't have been able to pay my mortgage. I would have been homeless. Not that my parents would have let me be homeless, but I would have totally ruined my life with that. So that was enough pain. You know, that was enough pain. I said, okay, I guess then that's what I have to do, is go to rehab. And so talked to my lawyer, got the court date postponed for that third DUI. Now, this is 3 and 5 now, and that's serious. The consequences compound. Anything else after that is a felony. Little Southern Baptist girl here, you know, fixing on the verge of felonies. And so I came and had my, came here, what did they do, the intake, had the evaluation done, and then was supposed to come back in the next week. On the morning first of all, on June 5th of 2005, I drank till midnight. Wait a minute. Yes. On June 5th, I drank till midnight. And the next morning when I woke up, my dad was going to come over and get me and bring me to Ridgeview. I called my mother and said, I don't know if I can do this. I mean, does that make sense? Does that make any sense? I'm going to lose every freaking thing I have if I don't go to rehab. And I'm saying, I don't know if I can go through with this. So I came in, and I think I still tested an illegal level just from the night before, but I do call June 6, 2005, my sobriety date. So I came in here, and again, I started hearing about the dysfunction in so many alcoholics and addicts' lives, and I think, I don't have a right to be an alcoholic. I was, you know, I didn't have all of that. I had it good. I didn't have all that. So, again, I had not started learning about the disease of alcoholism yet. Didn't think I belonged here either. I don't think it was till about, it was in that first week, but it was about three or four meetings before I could make myself say, hi, I'm Jamie, I'm an alcoholic. And I could say, I am an alcoholic. When I came in, or right before I came in, I was going, okay, this is a good thing. I'll quit for a couple of years, get through the consequences, get through probation, get my license back. I've got a drinking problem, not an alcoholic, but I got a drinking problem. And so if I can just get clean for 2 years, then I'll be okay. I'll be able to control it. Because the thought, as we all know, the thought of never, ever being able to take a drink again is foreign to us. Because everything I did, drinking, all those fun times with my husband, all those, every single thing involved alcohol and drugs for years. So if you do those things without alcohol and drugs, how could that possibly be fun? It's self-delusion going on up here. So I came in here, and I remember that first week being in this room. And the lecture, I don't remember what it was on, but you know, they're always talking about the first three steps pretty much in here. And so I can remember him coming over here, standing right where I'm at right now, going, hey, how is everybody? And throughout the audience, you're hearing, good, good, fine, okay, yeah, good, good. He came to the microphone, and he leaned into us, and he said, people, you're in a mental institution. You're not okay. And so that was that was monumental for me as well. It's like, I'm not okay, and it's okay to not be okay for now. And even in sobriety, there's been some times when I'm not okay, but I have tools now. But you know, back when we're drinking, it's like it's a constant effort to be okay, to be okay, to be okay with whatever. At work, with finances or whatever, and if we're kind of not okay, well, we drink, and then I'll feel okay then. And it's just, you know, the whole drinking thing is, you know, is such a self-delusion. So I heard that. Like I said, Dawn was in here. She had 3 years sober. I thought, I was like, oh my gosh, I will never, ever see that. I was just telling Eddie earlier, first time I heard his story in this room, he had 8 years, and I was like, never. It won't happen. It won't happen. I will never, ever be able to stay sober that long. And yet, here I am. So, now, going through, wait. I went through Ridgeview here. Now, I'm leaving out, about to leave out something. So I had court for DUI number 3. And again, I stood before Honorable Roland Castellano. And so I am just a mess. And I knew I'm fixing to get screwed big time. And he said to me, Miss Perry, you know, he's up here on the bench and I'm kind of down there trembling, you know. He said, Miss Perry, in all my times on the bench, I have seen people come in and get a DUI. And a few weeks later, they go out and get another one. But Miss Perry, I don't think I've ever, in all my time on the bench, had someone leave my courtroom and go out and get a DUI that night. You know, part of me wanted to say, well, Judge, when you find something you're good at, you know, run with it and all. But that would not have been appropriate. He would not have been impressed, I'm sure. And I was crying too hard to do that. So what happened with that is then 2 years later, when I got off of probation and got my license back, I had to appear before him again. And I would go into the courtroom there on the square and sit there and wait till he heard the cases and wait, you know, till all the cases been heard. The bailiff would come over and say, yes, what's your case number? And I said, no, I'm not here for a case number. I just want to speak with the judge when he's done. I said, okay. So I would sit there an hour sometimes, maybe a couple hours. They said, this is Miss Perry. She wanted to have a word with you. Well, he remembered me. And of course, I'm sobbing, you know. And I just wanted to tell you thank you for the mercy and thank you for the pain. Because if I'd had to do that 6 months, I wouldn't have ever made it. And so that was really cool. And I said, you know what? Every year I stay sober, I'm going to come back here and let you see me again. So I did that for about another 2 or 3 years. Would go in there and wait patiently. And then about the third or fourth time, and the bailiff would always say, what's your case number? I'm just here to see Judge Castellano. And so about the fourth time, I went in there and I said, what's your case number? And I said, no, I'm just here to see Judge Castellano. I want to speak with him just a minute. I said, okay. Bailiff comes back a few minutes later and says he wants to see you in his chambers. How does that happen? This man stood up there and convicted me and gave me mercy, and then here I am 4 years later sitting in the chambers with him like we're friends and chatting and just talking about life and stuff. And I mean, I did talk about sobriety and stuff like that. So I continued to try to get in touch with him. He went back into private practice. I think he was a little embarrassed when he told me he went back into private practice because he was now defending people like me, you know, instead of convicting them. But I was able to make phone calls. I've lost touch with him now, and maybe he's retired. But that was really cool to be sitting. I've never sat in a judge's chambers before, especially one that convicted me. And so there was that. That was really cool. In sobriety, I have lost both my parents. My mom died first. Well, first of all, when I was about 4 years sober, it was on a New Year's morning, and I had been able to go with her to a lot of her cardiac appointments. I kept thinking the doctor was putting her on a little bit too much meds or something like that, but you know, whatever. But the nurse in me wants to, I don't know. And so on New Year's morning, when I'm 4 or 5 years sober, my daddy calls me. They only live 10 minutes away, and he said, your mother's on the floor. And I said, and he called me before he called 911. I said, can she speak? He said, yes, she can talk to me. I said, I'll be there in 10 minutes, because I did not want the EMTs to take her to Wellstar, because her doctors were at Piedmont, and I wanted to make sure she went there. I dashed over there. Felt of her pulse. It was about 38, and I told him to call 911. Rode down to Piedmont with him, and I got him to take her to Piedmont since it was not a code situation. So I was able to do that for her. These two parents that had just sobbed over me, prayed over me, just, you know, shook their heads because they had no understanding of why I turned out. My older brother and sister, they didn't turn out like that. They didn't know what to do with me. But so there was that, and then I was able to go with her appointments to her. She got breast cancer and died 11 months from diagnosis. I can remember, when she died, there was the alumni here used to go up to Lake Allatoona to some camps up there every two or three times during the summer, and it was that weekend, and I didn't get to go because my mother had passed away. And so the funeral was on Saturday, I think. I'm in tears. I'm coming down there. You know, the family's sitting just in front. I look over here, and I bet there are 30 people from the alumni sitting over there. They had left their fun time up at Lake Allatoona, driven down here for my mother, who they had never met, for me. 3 years later, my dad passes. That was, you know, and of course, this is my last parent, so that was pretty tough. And just there toward the end, trying to get him, we had to take his license away, trying to get him set up in assisted living and such like that, and which I knew would be his demise because he would never be able to handle that change. And during all of that, just the emotional and mental pressure of all that, and I've shared this in many meetings, and I'm very transparent about this, a drink sounded like a good idea. I'm not kidding. A drink sounded like a good idea. But because of this program and what it has taught me, learned one thing very early, play that tape all the way through, and that has served me well, because even though it sounded like a good idea, it did not sound like a solution, and I knew that. I was with each of my parents. My sister had taken the night before being with them at the bedside with them. So it was my turn the next night with each of my parents. I was the one that was sitting there next to them when they took their last breath. My mother was so concerned about me, I think because I hadn't remarried, and I guess she thought that I really needed that. And you know, anybody who knows me well knows that I want a man, but I don't need one. Sorry. Sorry, that might have been one of those things that came out. But I went and laid next to her. I went and laid my head next to her, and I said, "Mom, I'm going to be okay. It's okay. You can go on." And I was the one there when my two parents, and I just think God did that because I'm a nurse, and my sister was kind of upset when my dad died, and she wasn't there again at the bedside. And I said, you know, God may be sparing you. I've seen a lot of dead bodies. I've seen a lot of people die in nursing, and it's not pretty. And I said, maybe God was sparing you from that. So there was that. Now, today, I think I got just a few more minutes. Today, like I said, it's like, you know, my friend Joe back there talks about life being lifey, and it sure is. It's life. And it's just amazing to me, when I reflect back, the self-delusion that I was in, and that we're all in our addiction. And other people, normal people, you know, they deal with life. But for some reason, you know, you lose a parent, you lose a job, somebody, you know, disses you or whatever, you know. We have to drink over that and do drugs over that because we just can't handle that. And that's just so odd to me now in sobriety that we just can't, and I don't have to do that anymore, though. I can get up and have a day that's, you know, people say my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk, and I can remember that. Let me touch back just a little bit, or God's going to be mad at me if I don't. You know, I grew up, like I said, the faith that I grew up with, and you hear a lot of people in these rooms say they grew up in the church and then it's just they adopt something different. I still have the same faith that I grew up with as a child. This program has helped me. I can remember asking Stan when we were up there at the lake my first or second year, and I said, "I just don't know how this AA is going to fit in with my faith." And he says, "I think you're going to find it fits in real well." And it has opened my eyes to so many more things. I do go to church. There's things I get in church that I don't get in these rooms, but there's things I get in these rooms that I do not get at church because a lot of those people just ain't like me. And I think that's what I'm going to wrap it up with, guys. It's 20 after, and thank you for giving me the honor of speaking before you. Thank you.
thank you so much, Jamie. I appreciate that.